Get ready to expand your horizons and discover great reads. This is Bookbound, a library podcast. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Jessica Trotter, and I'm joined at the mic by Cheryl Lindman and Maricela Garza. Hey, ladies.
Hello.
Hello.
We have actually a fun set of things that sort of match up, little groupings, but we also really want to talk about Cattle's One Grand Read. We are partnering with a number of groups across the area, including East Lansing Public Library and Michigan State, and we'll come back to that, but that's one of our big topics we want to cover today. But we just want to share a bunch of fun, interesting reads, I think, with you. Fun, maybe not all fun, but very interesting. Let's just get started, I think.
All right. Okay. Sounds good. I'm up first. This is Madi. I have Blood in the Water by Tiffany D. Jackson. This was amazing. I actually just finished it.
and it's one of the pretty books.
Yeah. And if I'm not mistaken, this is Tiffany Jackson's first middle grade book. For those of you who don't know, Tiffany Jackson is a best-selling author of numerous teen titles that are kind of on the thriller, action, mystery side. And this book is actually set on Martha's Vineyard. It features 12-year-old Kaylani. She's from Brooklyn. She's super smart, whip smart. I mean, she's like a lawyer in training, basically. There's several references in the book to wanting to be an attorney later in life. And her dad, one of the reasons is that her dad has recently been sent to prison for a crime he did not commit. He was set up. And her family is really just like, you know, she's really anxious. She's really interested in trying to exonerate her father or helping with that process. But her family just really wants to get her out of Brooklyn and, like, just be a kid. Just relax. You don't need to worry about this. This is an adult thing. So she gets to go to this beautiful home on Martha's Vineyard, and she's living with a family who are, you know, friends of her extended family. She's got two, let's just say, privileged young ladies who are her housemates, pretty wealthy, not very kind all the time. And, you know, she's just trying to adjust. It is really nice. But Chadwick is a teen man, or young man, who is also the ex-boyfriend of one of her housemates. He meets her, and, you know, he really challenges her to learn about the history of the African-American community on the island. Well, da-da-da, Chadwick gets killed off. I'm going to say that this is middle grade. It is very well done. It's very, very approachable. You know, even though he is murdered, there's not a whole lot of, this is not adult, you know, action thriller kind of content. I really liked that it was very approachable for an 11-year-old, a 12-year-old to read. But Kaylani, being the kind of attorney in training, she sets off to figure out who did it. Why did they do it? I really love that Tiffany Jackson just included so much history of that island. The Oak Bluffs town is still a community on Martha's Vineyard that has a long-standing tradition of just having African Americans kind of be in that community and live out their joy, live out being just prominent thinkers and creators. The Inkwell Beach, you just learn all sorts of interesting tidbits about why was it named Inkwell. I just really thought it was very well done, very very much a strong voice for a middle grade person. Kaylani just endearing, very endearing. And I'm going to say that there are a few references to Jaws, because there are some shark elements in the story. In fact, I almost didn't read it because the cover looks slightly scary. You don't see any blood on the cover, but Blood in the Water is something that might not have appealed to me, but I'm so glad I did pick it up and read through it.
Wow.
Cool.
sounds really interesting. I am going to move across the world to Australia for the next book. This is one of those books that I call the 2020 books. We talk about those. They were released in 2020. This one was June, so it was when the pandemic was a few months in and a really bad time for a book release. I feel like all of those books, we saw it in our collection analyses that we do, that those books struggled. It was harder for them to find some footing. So I wanted to bring this to the podcast attention because I think it's really notable, and it's one I wanted to read back then, and it took me a couple years to read it. It's called The Yield by Tara Sue Winch, and it was published in Australia first and then published in the United States. And it was not Tara Sue Winch's first book, but it's one that won her quite a few awards. And this work is takes place in New South Wales, in a similar area to one of the other books I talked about this year, in a town with an unfortunate name of Massacre Plains, which is reflective of the history in that area, too. It's on the Murrumbi River, which is also barely a river anymore because of environmental pressures in that area. Over farming in that whole stretch of land and other effects, you know, climate change really have dried up the river. And the people, Tara Sue Winch is Wiradjuri, and this book is about Wiradjuri people and about her family. But it's not autobiography, it's fiction. So there are three different threads in the story. There's the actual narrator of the story is Poppy Gondawindi. August is his name. That's her name. But it's her grandfather. And he's narrating this book and creating a dictionary of Wiradjuri terms. The dictionary is included in the back. It's actually real, based off of real terms, and it's 29 pages long. So he's narrating his story, the family story. It is a lot of removal, like in the United States, indigenous removal of the Aboriginal people. It's a difficult story. And he has taken in, early on, he takes in his granddaughters, and one of them is our other main character of the story. So she's coming back to this town because he's died. And she has left for England for a number of years because of trauma. She lost her sister. Literally, her sister disappeared. And that's part of the story, and there's a big mystery in this about, you do sort of figure out what happened to her sister. The other thread, the other third piece, the thread of the story is Reverend Greenleaf. So we get the story of a missionary, and he's very conflicted by the end of his work. He's like, what did I do? This is terrible. What are we doing? That sort of thing. So she does pull this all together, and the town and their community is threatened by a tin mine. So there's environmental activists there, too, trying to fight for this this development project. So it's quite the mystery. It's sort of a thriller. There's quite a bit of trauma, intergenerational trauma, and a very traumatic story with the sister that was lost. But it's actually a very redemptive and hopeful and beautiful book by the end, and just a really, really powerful work. I think this would appeal to readers of Louise Erdrich. I think it's a different type of writing, but I think it would appeal in similar ways. So I'm really glad that I read it. I think it's a beautiful, powerful book, a difficult book, but one I really wanted to talk about here.
All right. I also have a mystery, maybe the most traditional mystery of the set. It is called A Murder for Miss Hortense by Mel Pennett. This is a debut series starter featuring a Windrush community in Biggleswey outside of Birmingham, England. It's, if you're not familiar with the Windrush generation, this is group of immigrants from Jamaica to Jamaica and the Caribbean, British Caribbean, that came really at first to rebuild England following World War II to help out in the rebuilding. And so waves and waves of people came pretty much between like 1948 and 1973. And in this book, we have Miss Hortense immigrates from Jamaica in 1960. She ends up joining this community. She's actually following an older sister that she's hoping that she can kind of have a later life you know, with it doesn't quite work out the way she plans. She ends up actually training and becoming a nurse and lives out her life as a single, very skilled, very confident and assured woman. She's very observant. She, early on when she joins this community outside of Birmingham, she becomes sort of the center of a partner, which is a kind of a money group. The community that's part of the group each puts in a certain amount of money each month, and a portion of that is given, or a larger portion is then given to members of the group in turn over a period of time. And it's just sort of a way to help help the group build money. It was sort of to get away from the racism that was happening in the banks that would not let these working people actually create accounts. So, but you know, when the book opens, there's this long history. She is, for some reason, not the center of the partner anymore. In the very early scenes, you see her being kind of named the money holder. But she's now retired. She's still, she's gardening. She's kind of a marginal part of the community. People come to her when they need help to fix them up instead of going to the hospitals sometimes. But she's sort of a revered auntie in the community, in a sense. And the book opens with the death of one of the original partner members. It's a heart attack. There's nothing much to it. But one of her friends and one of the still members of the partner wants her to look into it because she has those skills, and they know she has those skills. She thinks there's something to it. Miss Hortense kind of believes her, but does not really want this excitable lady to be know that she might possibly be looking into it. And then another death occurs of an unknown man at the house of the woman who died by the heart attack. And it's definitely become something that Miss Hortense is going to look into. And you get, there's a dual storyline. There is a case that the group continues to talk about. It was never solved. It was the key point in Miss Hortense not being the center of the partner anymore. And there's some echoes of that with the most recent deaths. And so she very seriously wants to look into this, and she's wonderful at it. And there's all these fascinating characters are part of this community. And I will say it is written in their voices. So you're really going to hear the variations of Jamaican accent or different Caribbean accents coming through. It makes a wonderful audiobook. So I would highly suggest it. It's funny. It's really moving. I'm really looking forward to the next book.
This sounds so good.
Mm-hmm.
There's not that much about the Windrush generation. I think we've talked about some things here before. I have not read Andrea Levy's Small Island, but I saw the BBC movie based off of it. And I'm always looking for more, so I think this is really, really mm-hmm. sounds good.
Yeah.
Wow. Very cool.
Well, I have the next book. It is Safe Harbor by Padma Venkatraman. This is a verse novel. Beautiful book.
It's a cute cover.
Yeah, lovely cover. Just it features a girl who is Geetha. She is brought to the United States by her mom from India. Her mom is getting a doctorate or a PhD here in the States, and partially because she's trying to make a better life for her daughter. She's recently divorced. And Geetha's not really very happy about it. She's taken away from her pati, her family, her extended grandparents, her cousin, just everything she's known there. She comes to Rhode Island, and she's still taking her music lessons. She has this bamboo flute. And she's still taking online lessons. So it's really a really beautiful, beautiful story. But it's mostly the story of how she finds a seal that's hurt with a friend that she meets on the beach, Miguel. And kind of the story of rehabilitation and what we do with animals when we do find them. Should we take care of them? Should we take them into our homes? Should we always contact a rehabilitation center to try to rehome them eventually? Just a beautiful, beautiful story. I really liked also that there's a tiny bit of mention of mental health related to her mom and how not just one thing, you know, will help you. It's not just yoga. It's not just medicine. It's not just therapy. So many different things play into healing and finding balance and getting better. Geetha is someone who is really interested in animals, and I think that this really struck me because I see it among the little bit of community I have with children and just how interested they are in learning about animals, but also seeing them have a really best, great life. You know, we talk a lot about pollution and the problems that are affecting all living beings around our world. And Geetha really, you know, kind of hones in on that. And I was just really, it was just the language is just beautiful. And I listened to it and read it. And of the two, if you're going to only do one, I would recommend listening to it because the poetry that comes through this first novel is just so striking. Just this brave tiger that Geetha is referred to. Just loved it. Hope you enjoy it too.
Sounds lovely. Yeah. And there's some tie to the next book of mine, which is an adult nonfiction book, but the tides, the shore, the animals, seals. This book brings us back to the Arctic Circle. I talked about a book earlier this year set there, and this one is The Place of Tides by James Rebanks. And James Rebanks is a renowned author in England. His books have come over here and been really popular. He has Pastoral Song, Shepherd's Story, or Shepherd's Tale, I believe. He is a goes way back farmer of ancestral family land in England in the Lake District. And I think that's sort of his focus is on that sort of multi-generational story. So this one, when James Rebanks was younger, he came across this woman on a trip to Norway. He was on these archipelagos of the Norwegian Peninsula, all of these islands centered around Vega, which is an island that is a UNESCO heritage site. And he met this woman who was what called a duck woman, these people who maintain all of these duck nests. And it's this really labor-intensive process so that the eider ducks can come and have a safer place to lay their eggs and raise their young. The eider duck populations are declining, you know, based off all the reasons that you can imagine in this area. And so the eider, the duck women are sort of a national treasure to Norway in what they do for the eider ducks. So he met this woman years ago, and then in a chance opportunity, he's asked to go with this woman named Anna, who he'd met years before, to go for her last season. She's ailing. She's in her 70s. She's not doing very well, and she knows she can't keep doing this. So they go for the season. Ends up being about a month or so, and they go to this very remote island. I believe it's called Faroe. It's off of the island of Vega, but it's a very small island, and it's uninhabited. And they go, and they live in a very kind of rough way. They have a composting toilet. They make these really basic meals. They have to bring all the food there. They can't just run back and forth. And, I mean, this is a woman in her 70s, and the woman helping her is not that much younger. It's a friend of hers named Ingrid. So they take him, not to make a bad pun, but under their wing to help these birds. I couldn't help it. But and it's interesting, and they're completely at the mercy of the birds. The whole entire point of it is to, it's a summer, so it's those long, long Arctic days. But the whole point is to set up the conditions to hope that the birds will come. They never know. they just hope that they will, get these nest boxes really safe and secured. The nests are made with seaweed, too. It's really cool seaweed. You can see the pictures. And then they sort of just cross their fingers and hope that it works. And then one of the coolest parts of the book is there's this period of quiet. There's a name for it, sort of like a Norwegian word, where they have to be very, very quiet. They have to stay really low in the house because that's when the ducks are coming. And if they do things wrong, then the ducks will leave. The ducks are really touchy about things. So they have success on this island. Another really cool tidbit is that they have to pay the person who owns the land and another person in eggs. So they have to harvest a bunch of eggs, too. If they don't harvest enough eggs, then they're actually, she's like, has to pay for this opportunity to do this on the island. The eiderdown is used in down. It's used for down comforters and that sort of thing. And it's a way of life going back generations in her family. But she had to give it up. And there's a whole story about that. She worked at a nursing home till she was 50 years old. She raised children. She was married twice. She lived a pretty normal life on the island of Vega. And at 50 years old, she was like, forget it. I can't do this anymore. I've got to go be a duck woman. And so she left it to be a duck woman until this last season. So it's a really lovely book. It's very quiet. It's very still. And it's stilling. And it made me think of a movie that I just saw around the same time. It's called Tokyo Story. It's an old movie from 1953. It's an acclaimed film. I recommend you watch it because taking away from both of these, I just feel this stillness. And this stillness that we, in our culture, generally don't get to feel as much. And here are two a book and a movie about many other things. But the thing that really struck me was this focus and this stillness. I don't know, and you'll probably take out something different if you watch the movie or see the book, but that was sort of what came away for me as sort of a different way of living, a focused, still way of living. So very interesting, right. The Place of Tides.
All righty. Now we wanted to step back and talk about One Grand Read.
Yeah.
So we have a sort of county-wide, all-county read, sort of what this is. Our partners, with Capital Area District Library are East Lansing Public Library, City of East Lansing, Michigan State University, Hooked, the bookstore, Frandor area, and Schuller Books. Did I miss anybody? I think
nope.
I got everybody. And I was really excited to hear the title when it was announced. It's Better Living Through Burning by Christian Cooper. We will have Christian Cooper in the city on September 20th. He will be doing a talk for us at
Kellogg Center.
It's hard to say Kresge. I'm like, that is not the right Michigan State.
Wrong K.
Yes, wrong K. At Kellogg Center. We hope many of you will show up for some of the book discussions and some of the other events. If you haven't read the book, we have talked about it before. In fact, Cheryl and I read it at the same time. She did the talk about it on our earlier incarnation of our podcast, almost exactly two years ago.
Mm-hmm. August.
Yep. And
episode 82.
Episode 82. And we have kind of brought it up repeatedly ever since, as something that we really enjoyed. It is a book that I think appeals. It's his life, but if you're not familiar with Christian Cooper, this would be the Central Park birder who was accosted by a woman and an unleashed dog, and then threatened that she would call the police on him for doing nothing other than birding while being black. But he is somebody who has this is a memoir. He has such an interesting life.
Yeah.
He is very much now a birder, a naturalist. He's a writer. He worked for Marvel. Wrote one of the original, LGBTQ storylines for Marvel. He's just had quite an interesting life, and there's a lot of story, in that book.
Yeah.
And if anyone remembers Flacco, the owl from Central Park, Christian Cooper also wrote The Urban Owls, How Flacco and Friends Made the City Their Home. It's illustrated by Kristen Adam. And this is a really lovely, lovely nonfiction story about that period of time, or Flacco in general, being in the park, in the city, something I really like. And also, I just have to mention Birding for Babies by Chloe Goodhart. It's a little series, a board book series about birds. And, you know, there are some features to it, like numbers or opposites, colors, that sort of thing, but just a beautiful, beautiful collection of books by Chloe Goodhart. So I hope you'll check those out in our collection as well.
Adorable.
So we've created a bunch of lists. Which we will, we're kind of batched up on our catalog right now, but we can also share the link in our notes. But I've kind of since, I don't know if it was him first, it probably was, reading him kind of started me a lot down a lot of, I'd already been doing some nature reading, but this sort of really pushed me down and started reading more birding books. I've read a ton of birding books actually since his book. I'm hanging out more at places like the Tollgate Park and Bancroft Park, wandering around listening for birds and seeing other things in the process. I'm on hold. I think you all should know Library of Things has a birding kit.
Yeah.
And there's also
A Raising Readers backpack, and these are early literacy backpacks full of books and toys, and including like a little I don't know what you call it, a Picture-matic. You know, you kind of look through it and you press the button.
Yeah.
And
oh, okay.
These are kind of old school, but lots of beautiful images of birds in the Birds Raising Reader backpack.
But actually, kind of going back a little bit to your idea of stillness, that's sort of what's appealing to me about some of the sitting and listening that I've been doing is that while yes, I do have an app up listening for birds, I'm mostly just sort of sitting and looking around and looking up and actually being outside, which is something I needed.
Yeah.
So.
And Jessica took a really good picture of a heron the other day. Yes, it was gorgeous.
Yeah, I actually went around and tried to get my old digital camera up and working, and it's mostly working.
I think it paid off. It was a beautiful picture. Yeah, it's a really fun topic. We have books available for hold. We purchased extra books. We have lots of books for you. Our partners have books. The bookstores have books. East Lansing Public Library. So there are lots of opportunities to get your hands on the book. And again, our book lists have a lot of going off sideways in different directions. We even have some movies on there, kids' books, fiction,
TV shows,
nonfiction. Yeah, TV shows. Yeah.
Like Bertende Thurston series. Is on one of the there's a movie list, movie TV list.
Yes, right. Yep, so we're kind of going off in different directions from the themes in the book. There's a lot going on in the book. It's not just about birding, so I think there's a lot you can do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And the part about Marvel was really fascinating. Mm-hmm. I think it's really, really interesting just about working at that time, working against, you know, maybe the forces that were at play within Marvel and trying to trailblaze. It's really interesting. So, you have another book, don't you, about birding? That one. That's on our list.
And actually, yes, I do have a book. It's called Slow Birding, The Art and Science of Enjoying the Birds in Your Own Backyard. And it is really one of those things that one of the reasons I brought this one is because I think it's a really nice one. If you're interested in just getting started in birding, or it also really reminds people you don't need to hop in a car and drive miles and miles away to get acquainted with the wildlife. And, you know, you can sit in your backyard.
Sit on your porch.
She talks a lot about backyard birds, or your porch birds, your backyard birds, the ones that are in your neighborhood. This is by Joan E. Strassman. She's very much settled in the St. Louis area, but she is a native born in Michigan, and she talks about that and actually spending time at some of MSU's wetland areas where research is being done. But what I really like about this one is that she walks through, it's like there's chapters fully devoted to like backyard birds.
Cool.
So like the first chapter, you know, the ones that you see, and her backyards are a little different than ours, but it's really, really very similar. So she talks about the blue jay. Mm-hmm. We all have seen blue jays. You know, the American robin, that's probably the easy, and she says that's probably the easiest one to see. They just walk right out on the grass. And prior to kind of getting interested in this, I could have maybe, it's not that I didn't know birds, but all I ever remember seeing are robins and starlings and, you know, hearing a cardinal and hearing a bluebird. Mm-hmm. It's those, you know, those are the things, but there's so many more, and it's so interesting to see the variation. And in this particular book, she even kind of, you know, you have a chapter just on robins, and then at the end of it, she's like, you know, here's how you tell the females and the males apart. Spend some time, just sit someplace. When she talks about slow birding, she really means pull out a chair, just sit in the quiet for a while. If you walk into an area, you're disturbing their, you know, the environment, and they're going to be acting differently. Settle down, sit, and just enjoy the peace, and you'll start to see all the other things kind of going around. They'll start to work around you. I will do that at Tollgate, and Tollgate has a bunch of benches. This is in the Grosbeck area. And I was sitting on the bench. And yes, the heron just sort of was out there standing on a branch, started hopping around. The week before, again, same bench. I saw herons just swoop across in front of me, which by itself that was totally cool. But then they just actually circled right around, so they were like very, very close and just, you know, a few feet in front of me before heading over to the island in that park. And I just sort of like, it's so, and then you start to notice, okay, then there's the deer, and then there's the frogs, and then there's the, I really enjoy kind of slowing down, and that's part of this brook particularly. And that you also, you don't need to have a fortune. You don't need to go to giant traveling. There's so much to learn about the things right here in your own, you know, home area. So I highly suggest slow birding. I also want to mention that I'm in the middle of listening to Birding to Change the World by Trish O'Kane. And this kind of appeals to me in more of the social justice aspect of caring for our areas, letting people know about, you know, that Trish O'Kane works now with teaches a class that is called Birding to Change the World, where her students will go out into the local schools and spend days taking kids into wetland area and just teaching kind of kids who wouldn't necessarily otherwise do this, you know, about their community and about, you know, the environment. And it's so, I highly suggest that one too, though I'm only partially through it.
Sounds so good. Excellent. Well, it's an excellent theme. I'm so excited about this.
Yes.
Yeah, so we'll post all the information about the, we'll post the website, One Grand Read, too, so you can check all that out. My last book is by a great in the culinary world. Her name is Jessica B. Harris. She's the author of many, many books. I think it's 17. She's a culinary historian. She was the travel editor, I think, of Essence years ago. She has a long career in journalism and food writing. She wrote a book called High on the Hog, which has turned into a Netflix series about African-American foodways. So she is just a very prolific and wonderful writer. It's a beautiful book. This is Braided Heritage, Recipes and Stories on the Origin of American Cuisine. And this sort of starts out with sort of a premise or an assertion. She says that American cuisine is a braided heritage from three, and of course she admits it's many, many braids, many pieces, many strands in the braid. But the three main parts of the braid are indigenous cuisine, European cuisine, and she focuses on four specific areas in particular in this book, and African cuisine and how they all come together to make what is American cuisine. And then she focuses a little vignette, little chapters on people that she knows in the food world. You know, there's Sean Sherman, the indigenous chef, Charlotte Lyons, who was the food writer for Ebony for many years. And she has beautiful recipes, lots of storytelling, lots of focus on things like wild rice. It's, you know, the heritage of wild rice. It's absolutely beautiful. Lots of good history, good information about the different types of immigration to this country. So it's got a little bit of history. I love these books. I was just thinking about this. I mean, cookbooks have always been fun and beautiful. And like the 60s, 70s cookbooks were fun and quirky. They had those like really colorized pictures. I think they look fun. But modern cookbooks are blowing stuff out of the water because they're really works of photographic art. I mean, yes, food photography absolutely. Is a thing, and they're just a pleasure. I have to say, I check out a lot of cookbooks. Poor Hazlitt Library. However, do I make much of the food? Not so much. It's like retirement dreams, you know? But I made something out of this book. I'm so excited. I made hot water gingerbread, and the story about this one is really fun. The author, this is one of her recipes in this section, she said that she was on the late Dr. Betty Shabazz's radio show, and she... talked about this hot water gingerbread cake, and Dr. Betty Shabazz said that it was one of Malcolm X's favorite cakes, actually. So it was kind of fun. And there's no egg in it at all. It's boiling water and molasses. I made this for my husband because it was his birthday, and he loves like gingerbread. It's not like it looks like a brownie almost, yeah. But it's just a nice, thick, really spicy gingerbready cake. And it was wonderful. It really was. And I make it gluten-free, so everything gets kind of screwed up when I make food, and it still was good. So that means it's actually a really great recipe. Because I feel like it always isn't quite right, you know, because of the way I have to make it. But there's cinnamon shortbread cookies, pain de polvo, red rice, red beans and rice, Huguenot torte, which I thought was really cool sounding. Which is just beautiful. It's got like apples and pecans and all this stuff.
You know it's good
stuff.
If they're doing a two-page spread photo right? of it.
It's so beautiful. Oven-baked yams. So some things are more simple, but the red beans and rice looks really, really good. So there's tons of stuff. There's rutabaga in here, which is fun for me because rutabaga was one of the things that were French-Canadian, Quebec kind of area.
I love rutabaga. I have some in my
really,
it's vegetable drawer right now.
A lot of people don't like it or they don't know about it, but that's always on our Thanksgiving table, mashed rutabaga. Mm. And this was a little different. It had like bacon in it or something. It was in the African section of the cookbook. So it was just really fun to like, I really, really enjoyed this. And I just love these cookbooks because you learn so much. They're not just about the recipes,
right.
You know. They're very rich, and this is going to be one of my favorite books of the year for sure. And I'm checking out the series, this High on the Hog Netflix series. It looks really, really cool. So that was really fun.
Okay, from a cookbook to Automatic Noodle by Annalee Newitz. This is a novella in which you are introduced to a group of formerly deactivated robots who power back up mostly out of something recognizes the danger. Their place is flooding because of a rainstorm. They are in a post-war, post-apocalyptic post-war San Francisco. America has split kind of in two. And kind of California is kind of off doing its own thing. It's survived, but this group of robots has been working in a really crappy restaurant, and they're very aware of this. They are mostly free, though some of them are kind of paying out contracts and are kind of tied to this location.
Right.
They decide, since they are stuck and they're kind of owner landlords are deadbeat, kind of non-existent, not around. They decide, for the sake of keeping them all together and making some money, they're going to open up a restaurant. And they don't entirely know, but one of them is hellbent that he would like to make authentic noodles. So a Chinese pulled noodle.
Oh.
That's what he wants to do.
Wow.
Or what it wants to do. They all have interesting... It's
gender is very interesting in almost all of Anna Lee Nuetz's work, but in this, it is interesting with the robots and my reading of it. But they kind of scam the system. They get a name. They get listed in the, it's like the kind of, it's an obnoxious version of Yelp that you actually have to, you have to be rated highly in this or you're never going to go anywhere. And they go out and they've got, one of them is sourcing ingredients, another, a pair of them have gone out, or a group of them go out to real restaurants with humans who are pulling the noodles, and really neatly the chefs take pity on them and actually let them sit and watch and learn and ask questions for a short period of time until, you know, he's like, either you buy something or we need to move along because there's a line. But it's this group of robots becoming a community of themselves, but also becoming part of this neighborhood, inviting in other androids or robots to come in as part of the community. It's a mix of humans and robots. Obviously, they're making food for the robots, don't need it. But it's exploring the concepts of thriving as the other, found family, build a community. It's sometimes heartbreaking because you've got, everybody has a bit of a backstory, but it's often really funny. And it's a novella. It's just short, but there's so much going on in it, and I really loved it. And I talk about library reads every once in a while. It's the library reads top pick of this month. Of all the books that librarians thought were coming out, this was the top pick for August. So,
and it has a cool cover.
It does have a cool cover.
Really neat. Colorful.
Neat. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I do have the last book. I have a children's nonfiction title. It's Hiding in Plain Sight, Kate Warren and the Race to Save Abraham Lincoln. It's written by Beth Anderson and illustrated by Sally Warren Comport. I did not know very much about Kate Warren. Actually, we still don't really know that much about her, but she was known to be the first female detective. And at the time that Abraham Lincoln was elected and ready to go off and start his presidency, he was taking like a train tour through all these cities. And there were many threats to his life. And he apparently just refused to really change his route. And Kate Warren, who was working for the Pinkerton National Detective Agency, who we never sleep. I mean, there's this cute, nice little advertisement in the book about the agency. But it's really just the story of how they convinced him to, you know, make these different stops and different transfers unbeknownst to the wider public. Really an interesting book. And I'm going to say even that the back matter is probably where the story shines the most. You just learn so much about the history of that time, railroads and how they were used, how many different depots and stations there were. Not like today where, you know, we're glad to have still trains still working. But I really enjoyed this. This would be perfect for a third grader, about 33, 35 pages. Really a great nonfiction picture book.
Wonderful. There's a lot of takeoffs. I mean, there's, we were talking about this yesterday. There's a lot of different stories about Kate Warren over the years.
There is another one that we have in the collection. I'll put it in the show notes. I can't remember, but it was, that one's also a nice title.
You had never heard of her?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Well, I don't know where I've been, but.
Yeah.
I think there somebody, and I want to say Kate, but I'm not entirely sure of that, that there's a staff member who was regularly recommending one of the other Kate Warren books at one point. And so
I forgot to mention, I just want to throw this out there because I love how our books like communicate with each other somehow. Braided and Braided Heritage, Jessica B. Harris
her family had a place on Martha's Vineyard.
Oh,
isn't that
okay.
just so?
Yeah.
And that's where she writes from. And I looked at an interview with her, and it was like Food and Wine or something. They're saying, "What are you going to do after this book?" And she's like, "I'm going to the vineyard, and I'm just resting.
Yeah.
Stillness.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to be." Yep. She's ready after this book.
Yeah.
But that's where her family had a place going back for a long time. So
Tiffany Jackson, also the author of that first title, also is very familiar with Martha's Vineyard, which is, you know,
wow.
This,
what a weird coincidence.
Yeah, it's, we sort of pick our things in a silo and then come and talk to each other and think, oh,
yeah.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly we're hanging out too much. No. So that's what we wanted to cover. Don't forget the One Grand Read event and programming all around that.
Yeah.
There's a website with events, some reading material, kind of ideas to think about when you're looking at the book, and links to our lists. So we will share a lot of that in the show notes, but happy reading,
happy
everybody.
End.
Yeah, and happy summer. Enjoy the heat.
I don't want
I
the
am.
Summer to end.
Last
I'm sorry.
Month summer.
I feel like yesterday was May and it's already August and I don't
right?
understand.
Yeah, it's actually, we're recording this one on August 1st, so
really
hard to believe.
Yes, happy August. All right, happy reading, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.